Grave Tone.
Welcome to Grave Tone Podcast, where horror comes to life in every form it takes. I'm Megan.
And I'm Arthur.
And we're talking about childhood trauma again today.
Yeah.
But not by ourselves again.
That's right. Eventually you run out of childhood traumas. Well, not really.
No, well, I don't know. That's an interesting talking point. I don't know. I feel like eventually you're kind of like, you know what? I was already indoctrinated at this point, so I just stopped being bothered by the movies that I was watching.
Indoctrinated.
Correct.
Jesus. What kind of cult did you grow up on?
Anyway, today we are revisiting some childhood traumas with our friends over from Drawn to Darkness podcast. So Annie and Caroline are here. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us. We're excited.
Thank you for hopping on. This was an interesting childhood trauma to do because it did feel like this was the first time that we were doing childhood trauma films that were actually kind of made for children, which I don't think we've done previously.
No, definitely not.
So it kind of gave us an opportunity to watch some kids' films that were maybe like way darker than they should have been. So this was kind of a fun double bill for us. So today we are talking about Return to Oz and The Peanut Butter Solution, both of which came out in 1985, which is a weird thing that I
completely coincidental too, because like I chose Return to Oz and Caroline chose Peanut Butter Solution.
Yeah.
And then there's so many weird things they have in common, like the time, but also just that like fever dream aspect that people are like, did I really watch this?
Very much. I feel like they both have that same vibe. I think, I mean, obviously in terms of audience, Return to Oz has a larger audience because it's a Disney production. It's sort of a sequel to the 1939 adaptation of The Wizard of Oz, kind of, a little bit, sort of. But it, you know, doesn't pretend to be like a film that's just for children, I guess, is kind of what it is with the themes that it tackles. That was that weird period in the 80s where Disney went like really dark and they were like, do you know what we should do? Scare some kids.
Should do it again.
Like, I would be fine
Labyrinth.
With that. Yeah.
Black Cauldron, Black Hole, Willow.
Even the cartoons were really dark. Like, I loved The Secret of Nim so much. And I was listening to another podcast cover it, and I was like, this is actually really dark.
It is. No, genuinely, I agree. I don't know what they were going through during this period, but a lot of the writers for Disney were like, oof, oh boy, rough.
They were going through some dark times, the writers, I guess. I don't know.
I guess so.
This is that 80s, go ahead and scare your children, traumatize them. It'll harden them up. Vibe, I think.
We were just, I guess people were just okay with it at the time. I shouldn't even say people. Like we were born like at the literal tail end of the 80s, so I don't know. I don't remember most of it, but you know.
It did harden me up, so I'm afraid of nothing.
If you have heard Queen, what's her name? Mombi. Scream out, Dorothy girl. You're good for life.
I have questions about whether or not they used some sort of voice modulator on the actress because there were multiple takes and times where she yelled and I was like, that doesn't even sound like she sounded at the beginning of the film.
Well, she does have different heads.
True. Yeah. Point. Excellent point. That might be why. I don't know. Anyway, okay. So we'll kick things off with Return to Oz. Obviously, we mentioned it was released in 1985. It is a Disney property and is sort of a, I guess, spiritual sequel to the 1939 MGM film, The Wizard of Oz, which obviously everybody knows. But obviously also these are a book adaptation. These films are based on the Land of Oz series by L. Frank Baum. The first novel, which is the most famous one, was published in 1900. And this film apparently is like a combination of two of the slightly later novels that he published. So he published 14 Oz books in total. And after his death in 1919, there were a number of people who kind of took up the mantle and then published subsequent sort of sequels or things that are set in the same universe afterwards. But the initial novels that he actually published full length were 14, apparently. This movie is meant to be a combination of The Land of Oz, which was published in 1904, and Ozma of Oz, which was published in 1907. I think there's something to say with, you know, because I mean, like, we're coming off of, this is weird to revisit because we're coming off of like Wicked over the last couple of years. And so revisiting this is interesting because it just sort of shows that this franchise has some real staying power because we're over 120 years later and it's still going and we're still getting some form of adaptation, some form of something. Like, people are obviously still fascinated by this.
It series. Did well, so they just keep making
it. I mean, yeah, they can make money off of it, but still, nevertheless, I think there's something to be said about it. Anyway, L. Frank Baum was a strange person, so I won't really get into too much about his stuff because we don't have time, but anyway.
I did read those first three books.
Oh, really?
Well, as my side quest to accompany this, I rewatched The Craft, which was really fun because
about that too. Yeah.
And then I reread, I read the first three books. And it's, so we can blame L. Frank Baum for like Princess Mombi, Belina, the Wheelers, the Gnome King, but not the electroshock therapy. Disney came up with that.
No way.
What a weird choice.
That is not right.
That might be the more horror part of the film, if we're honest. Totally. Like, you know, the dark fantasy feels like it happens when they're in Oz in the middle, but I would argue that the first, 30 minutes of that film are a horror film in and of themselves. Just electroshock therapy for children. Let's just fix it by shocking kids. And you're like, got insomnia? Let's shock you about it.
Like, they had a very solid logic.
It's weird.
Yeah, well, also speaking of that logic, did you notice how she was like, you're no good to me if you're tired? Like, she wants to fix her so she can work, so she can be better.
There's nothing about it. I mean, also, like, I feel like this is such an interesting one because the original film doesn't really explore the idea that perhaps Dorothy got a bump on the head during the tornado and then experienced some sort of psychosis. This film, I feel, kind of leans into that and is like, oh, now she's having dreams about it and everything. And then she falls into a river and then is conveniently back in Oz again. And I'm like, so this poor girl is experiencing mental health issues.
Yeah.
I think she actually got the shock therapy. And that's sent her back
to
Oz.
You said that, didn't you? When we
that's
were
what I said,
it.
Because the moment they were about to turn on, the electricity disappeared.
Yes.
Right? And it's like, oh, it didn't work. I think it actually worked.
wink.
Yeah. And like Annie said, it actually did happen.
I think
that's my theory.
Yeah, no, I agree. Obviously, this film is much, much, much darker in tone compared to the first film, of course. And it does seem to follow, I mean, the story, yes, but also the tone of the novels, I think, a little bit more closely, because I think there's more danger and things for the characters.
There's more danger, but there's no tension.
Okay.
You know, so it's like, okay, these things are happening. But for example, with the Wheelers, which is my childhood trauma. Those things terrified me as a kid.
They're weird.
And what happens is, like, it pretty much happens as it happens in the movie, but, you know, they threaten to rip her to pieces and they converge on her. But within several minutes, the fear factor is removed because they catch the Wheeler and he says, you've discovered our secret. Like, being so helpless, our only hope is to make people afraid of us by pretending we are so fierce and terrible. And it's like, immediately it's like, oh, actually, this is okay. Whereas they leave them scary in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Question, do they explain how Wheelers, are those their hands? Like, how do they eat?
Okay, I have one more quote about this, and it is so fucking scary. Okay, this is the scariest part of the
book. Hopefully we can swear on this podcast.
Can we swear?
Yes.
Oh, wait, Nelly and Anthony have been on. You can swear.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yep. You bet.
Shout out to Horror Roulette. They swear more than anyone I know.
They're British.
It's you, Caroline.
Wow, that's a feat. Continue.
So this is a quote from the book. These odd wheels were of the same hard substance that our fingernails and toenails are composed of.
Oh, I hate
that. So just imagine that.
So they actually made them better in the movie.
So they're less.
Because in the movie, it's actual wheels.
Yeah, they're
mechanical.
Wheels. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, that's it. They're just wheels that they roll on to get around. Oh.
I mean, there's something about the length of their arms that really gets me. Like, it reminds me of Freddy Krueger, like one of my scariest other childhood traumas.
In the first film when he, like, stretches out and extends.
In silhouette. Yeah. And I think that this reminds me of that. Also, there's, you know, they're kind of scary clown coded as well.
Yeah, they are.
So there's that maniacal laughter that they have giggles.
They have a distinct Riddler quality, I find, from the DC universe sort of.
Clockwork Orange. Yeah.
I'm thinking of like Clockwork Orange, like Joker, like Jim Carrey Joker.
But they also remind me of
not Joker, Riddler.
Yeah, they also remind me of Biff's clan in Back to the Future 2.
Yes,
a lot. Like they were even dressed. They were like stylized. Like, well, I guess Biff's clan was stylized after this.
Yeah.
And
Biff has that whole like maniac quality to him. Right. Like, they're the way they yell is really heightened.
Or Griff. I think Griff is his grandson or whatever. Like
they do have that vibe. That's true.
I agree. Can you tell us, can you set the scene for when you watch this? So like how the first old time you were, were you just sitting in the dark and freaking yourself out? Like how did this happen?
I don't know. I'm assuming we rented it. We didn't go to a lot of movies in the cinema. So I'm assuming we just probably were, you know, hapless 80s parents thinking we are renting the sequel to The Wizard of Oz, which is bright and happy. And, you know, it's got dark moments, but ultimately it's a very optimistic, sweet, heartwarming film. Right. And then we got this. And I just remember being... I guess the scenes that terrified me the most are two we've already discussed, the electroshock therapy and that whole asylum, which is like a horror in itself. Like
it is.
The silent attendants, the creaking cot that she's strapped to. And, you know, there's patients screaming in the background. It's just so horrifying from the beginning. And then, I don't remember exactly how old I was or anything like that. I just remember being like, in my childish way of expressing it, this movie is fucked. You know, I didn't swear back then, but
no, but that's fine. That's pretty much that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. So I mean, for people who maybe are listening and haven't necessarily watched the movie, essentially it follows Dorothy a while after her first adventure in Oz. She's suffering from insomnia, and her Uncle Henry and Aunt Em decide that the way to fix it is to take her to a specialized psychotherapist of some sort who will perform
experimental.
Like an experimental surgery. It's 1899, so people were wild, but it just, you know, take her to some sort of probably unlicensed physician to perform some kind of form of electroshock therapy, essentially. Now, keep in mind, too, that also what this film, I think, does well is to remind you, because when you watch the 1939 film, it's very clear that Judy Garland was about 16 when she made the film, and she just looked a lot older. You know, the character is meant to be like 9 or 10, like she's young. Mm-hmm. And so this version of Dorothy, this is Firouza Bakht's first film, is my understanding. She's the age of the character. She was 9 or 10 when she filmed the movie because she was 11 when it came out. So she's fantastic. She actually matches the actual character in the novels, which is good. And it does make you feel a little bit more afraid for her because she's so young and she looks so young. So the stakes feel higher for this character in this beginning when she's in this place sort of being silent. You know, this very sort of cold and scary nurse is telling her to come with her down a dark hallway. They're strapping her to the bed. That was insane.
I know.
I'm not comfortable with that.
I hate it.
That nurse in her like horrifying black spiky dress, like these are not hospital scrubs, right? No. Like, why not is she wearing that?
Not at all. I mean, this is another film that also does the same thing that the original film does, and that there are people in dual roles, right? So the actress who plays the nurse, I need to go through the cast list because I can't remember anyone's name. I know I mentioned Firouza Bakht plays Dorothy.
Jean Marsh is the nurse.
Ah, that's it. Jean Marsh plays the nurse. Wilson is the name of the character at the beginning of the film, and she also plays Princess Mombi when they're in
Oz. And she also plays the evil Bav Morda in Willow, if any.
Oh, God, that's who that is. Thank you.
She's, like, known for being a source of childhood trauma.
She's basically an evil witch in everything.
Yeah. And she played, I looked her up, I haven't seen this, but she played Bertha Rochester in a version of Jane Eyre. So
interesting.
That's another creepy character.
So also another creepy and unsettling character. Weird. Yeah. I guess she had a vibe for it. So she plays those characters. Nicole Wilson plays the doctor, J.B. Worley, but he also plays the Gnome King in Oz later on, who's another, again, you know, Dorothy's sort of whatever trauma she's experiencing manifests itself in Oz, where the people who are traumatic to her in actuality are traumatic to her in Oz. Well,
and there's nothing like that in the books. In the books, she's there. Like, it's not like, a dream. She's just there. In the book, she gets transported back there on a ship to Australia. She's, like, going to visit Australia, and, relatives or something, and the ship has a storm and she gets blown off.
What is it with Australia and the two movies that we're talking about
today? I know, right? That's another commonality.
So true.
Weird parallel. So those are those characters. Emma Ridley plays the character of Princess Ozma, who's also the girl who's at the hospital, who shows up, who's very confusing in the early scenes of the film. We have characters like the voice cast, obviously, or like the remainder of sort of the characters that Dorothy meets throughout the course of her time in Oz. I mean, Denise Breyer voiced the character of Belina, who's her chicken.
The best
Belina was obnoxious. She's my favorite.
I loved her.
I hated her.
I love her. Great.
Can we have a vote? Who hates Belina? I hate Belina. You love
Belina. Yeah, I was not into Belina.
Arthur, tiebreaker? Well, I guess it would be a tiebreaker.
No, I like the character because she was so annoying.
It's I thought she was hilarious.
Or maybe because she brought that whole thing of like, oh my god, the chicken is the end of the world. We need to.
Oh my god, yes, I loved that. That
be
was
scared
great.
Of it.
And chicken. That, oh my god,
hilarious.
That was so confusing too. Like, I mean, I knew the purpose that Belina served. Like, I understood it was levity. Like, that you need to have.
Yes.
This is
yes.
intended to be for children, believe it or not. And so you need to have somebody who's like bringing things back to levity after they're talking about like a mortgage, which I'm like, I don't know why anyone would have a mortgage conversation in a movie for kids. I didn't know what a mortgage was until I was a full adult.
No.
So, but yeah, but I, as an adult, I was sort of like, okay, this is like taxing.
Well, I think she's just meant to be that way because obviously like she has, you know, issues as just the chicken on the farm at the beginning. She's not laying eggs anymore. It felt very chicken yeah. run. I had yeah, chicken
she
run
needs
moment.
To work too. Right. Exactly. There's a lot of pressure yeah. to perform or die.
All the women in this so movie are expected to do all of the work. I'm just mm-hmm. saying, you know, mm-hmm. even I will say like also, you know, you have the character of Annie M is played by Piper Laurie in this
Always
movie,
scary.
Which I was like, which was what got 11 years after she'd done Carrie. Wow. Yeah. yeah. That was a while back.
I cannot see Auntie M as nurturing. I mean, she, aside from the fact that she is bringing her ward to get electroshock therapy,
yeah.
but like because she plays Margaret White and also that total awful character in Twin Peaks.
Yes. Yes. I can't remember the character's name.
But yeah. Wait, and then she's like trying to be. She's like the fighting with Josie over the sawmill in Twin Peaks. She's like oh, evil and conniving.
Got it. Right. Yeah.
I can't remember okay. her name either, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, those are her kind
I'm
of
I'm kind of like, don't give me that crap that you missed Dorothy at the end. Like,
yeah, they try to like, it's like they realize at the end, they were like, oh, we can't make her seem like a total bitch. We have to do something to try and redeem her. When you're just looking at her, she's like, okay, I'll be back for you tomorrow. I have to get back to Henry. I'm like, you're leaving her there.
And okay. then like, I guess, you know, what is the message of this film? Because is it, if you are traumatized, keep it to yourself? Because ultimately, like, Dorothy is in the mirror seeing Ozma and Auntie Em's coming up the stairs and Ozma's like, shh, or they'll send you back to the asylum.
Yeah. Like, so you're like, okay, true. So this girl is crazy. And we're like, okay, now if you are experiencing a psychotic break, don't tell anyone about it.
Yeah.
You have to put in the work and say nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So slavery.
Oh, one the Reagan thing, like, years.
I do want to give this film credit because, you know, there's the whole misconception that children are resilient, right? And even though they seem resilient and they look like they're coping, in reality, they're not. And trauma impacts kids. And Dorothy is yeah. traumatized, right? Like, whether it's because she's traumatized because she experienced this twister and passed out or because Oz actually happened.
Yeah. You know,
at least it's acknowledging that trauma doesn't just go away. Like, she's suffering from insomnia.
That is true. She's like experiencing actual trauma. It's very rare that we get a sequel of this sort of nature in which we're actually getting to see a character who's experienced something negative previously actually dealing with that yeah. trauma or the fallout
totally.
From it in any capacity.
Usually it's like, oh, nothing happened. Like, here's the sequel.
And then ta-da, and we're fine. Yeah. Or like either there's no sequel, so you never get to see it. Or if you do see it, the person is somehow coping completely fine. Mm-hmm. And for like a 10-year-old child,
no.
I just don't know how that would be possible. So
you were talking about that in something recently, Caroline, about.
Yeah,
you
know, I was talking about. Or... Yeah, what I was talking about was how in sitcoms and TV series, this often happens where something tremendous, traumatic, or addiction, something occurs and there's like a full reset next week. It's like it never happened, you know. Yeah. They don't have any lingering effects of a trauma. And that always really bugs me.
Is there any follow-up in Saved by the Bell when is it Jesse gets addicted to like caffeine pills or something?
Yeah, I recently learned that that absolutely was intended to be Speed, and like it was like the parent council or something like that. And they literally just took the script and replaced the word Speed for caffeine, so they didn't change anything about like the effects of caffeine versus Speed.
Well, because it doesn't make that what she experiences makes no sense with caffeine pills. So now I'm like a bit of a joke. But that is
such a fun fact about that episode. I had no idea.
Yeah, I can't remember. It's some other podcast I was listening to, because that's all I do is listen to podcasts all day and all night. But also 90210, like 90210 was like a after school special for the first couple of years, and they dealt with serious important issues. But it was frustrating that it was like the next week. It was like it never happened. You know?
Yeah, everybody would always just move right on, and mm-hmm. you're like, I don't think life works that way.
There's no timeline. Right. Shows.
No,
it's just something happens and that's it.
Yeah. And then they're mm-hmm. like, well, we don't have the energy to, you know, in the writer's room to add it to an actual, you know, make it an arc. Absolutely not. Bye. Next. It's like mm-hmm. a Monster of the Week episode, but for addiction and other horrible things that happen.
Yeah.
Well, having said that about giving this film credit for the depiction of lingering trauma, it's still probably not a good message for 7-year-olds.
Agreed.
No, not
at all. gosh. Okay. So Belina is one character that Dorothy, I mean, technically takes with her into Oz, quote unquote, is sort of it because she already exists on the farm outside of that. So Belina is her Toto substitute in this film. I was making the connections throughout the entire movie. I was like, okay, so Belina is like her Toto for this movie. And then
Toto.
Pretty much,
yeah.
And then when she arrives in Oz, she pretty much immediately meets TikTok, who is your Tin Man replacement, mm-hmm. essentially, from the original story as well, who is a member of the army in Oz, who was put aside basically by the Scarecrow who now rules Oz, which that was not in the movie. I have not read these books. Is that a thing in the original book? He runs Oz at the end, the Scarecrow.
Yeah, he is given Oz at the end of book one, and book two is all about a revolution by girls.
Oh.
So these girls revolts, they're like these girl warriors who poke at people with knitting needles. And then the whole thing, I can't tell if it's feminist or sexist, because the whole thing is like all the men are forced to do the work, and then they're all like so tired and like can't handle it, but ultimately order is restored and it's like things are better because the women are back to doing the work. So questionable messaging.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, I mean, it seems like in his life he had questionable messaging about like very contradictory statements about indigenous people and things like that over the course of his life. So who's to say? I don't know. That maybe his writing was much the same way.
Yeah.
So TikTok's our Tin Man replacement. He's like a wind up toy almost, but is like the least efficient fucking wind up on the planet. It's so stupid.
How did he take out the wheelers?
Literally. When every 10 seconds, he's like, oh no, my action does not allow me to continue it unwound. Oh dear. I'm like, a wind up toy was a really poor choice for this.
Also, and the construction, so she even says it in the movie, like, why didn't they put the winding thing in front?
I have no fucking
idea. So you can do it yourself.
Yes.
Just terrible design choices.
Yeah, bad, very bad. Bad all around. Bad choices. Like, he's adorable. He's like a little tin suit, like a little chubby tin suit. Like, he's so cute. He's all like very rotund. Like, he's just like a big circle, like a marshmallow that's made of metal, and it kind of like scoots forward. Like, it's cute, but I'm kind of like, this is really inefficient.
A prototype that should have been amended in later versions.
I just feel like the original Tin Man is much more efficient with regards to what he can do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that Tin Man story that she tells the doctor at the beginning, and she's like, and then he chopped his arm off and he chopped his leg off. That's from the story that the witch cursed his axe so that he slowly chopped himself up and just replaced himself. So that's pretty dark.
Yeah, wow. It sure is, because that's not a thing in the 1939 film that you see. No, everything's just there. Very happy.
No explanation.
But I will say, I keep on saying it, but really the horrors of the 1939 film were just the making of behind the scenes and what happened to the actors and what happened to the people who were involved with the production, Judy Garland all the way down to all of the other members of the cast, some of whom had to be replaced due to illness from makeup, from things like burns that occurred during stunts on set, like all sorts of absolute insanity. If you go down a little bit of a rabbit hole, it's very easy to find the information about this. And it's wild what people went through to make this film. So,
yeah.
So it's nice to know that nobody was grievously injured in any capacity when they were making this follow-up. Yay, well, 80s. Yeah, well, that's it. You know, 40-odd years later, they're kind of like, yeah, no, don't worry about it. We're fine. So yeah, those are the characters. After this, they meet the character of Jack Pumpkinhead, who they find in Princess Mombi's castle or whatever it is, voiced by Brian Henson, who's the son of Jane Henson, which I think is super fucking cool. Obviously, they also had a lot of puppeteers and people who were working like the body part, like TikTok had somebody who played the in-suit performer, a person named Michael Sundin. Stuart Larange played the body sort of double or performer for Jack Pumpkinhead, because obviously he had to be like very tall and skinny. So
could he like stop calling Dorothy his mom?
Yeah, that was weird.
That was weird.
You know, I think he would have been my favorite character if he hadn't have just done, like, if they hadn't have made that character choice. I was like, oh, I hate that very much. Because
but it's not a book. Except in the book, cute. It's Ozma at that point. But Ozma has been cursed to be a boy.
Oh.
And so he's calling him dad or father. And then Ozma gets revealed at the end. Oh, you're actually a girl and you're a princess.
Wow.
Lots of misplaced Freudian weirdness.
Some weird gender stuff in these books.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Ozma is believed, or, you know, called by some to be the first transgender character in a children's book.
Interesting.
Even though it's a curse. Oh. So.
Right. I would. Well. I'm gonna say hard disagree if it's a curse.
It's a curse.
And not an internal understanding of your own self.
I don't think anyone had an internal understanding of transgender identity in the early 1900s. No. So probably it was probably seen as a bad thing, which is
nobody Western. That's for sure.
Correct. Mm. Yeah, that's it. So that character, which I think that's it, other than the mom stuff, would have been my favorite character. He's adorable. Mm. I love him. He's so cute.
And and he inspired Jack Skellington. So Tim Burton was inspired by him.
Oh, he had to have been.
So much.
While we were watching the film, I was like, this has to be where Jack Skellington came from. There's no question. And then one of the last characters that we meet later on, which was, this was a whole weird choice, was Lyle Conway, who voices the character of the Gump, which is basically a decapitated like moose head.
Yeah.
Been
Gump
attached
reminded
to,
me of Forky from Pixar.
Oh my God. From Toy Story.
Because he's like, why am I alive? This is
I'm trash.
And here's a quote from the end of book two. Gump is offered a reward for, like, you know, restoring Princess Ozma.
Yes.
And for his reward, he says, please take me to pieces. I did not wish to be brought to life, and I am greatly ashamed of my conglomerate personality. Once I was a monarch of the forest, as my antlers fully proved, but now in my present upholstered condition of servitude, I am compelled to fly through the air, my legs being of no use to me whatsoever. Therefore, I beg to be dispersed.
Jesus.
So, you're just asking for death.
These books are not for children.
No.
Man, shit back in like the 1900s all the way through like the 50s and 60s, you read things about like children's stories and you're like, what was this? I mean, it's like, it's very much like Grimm's fairy tales and things like that, right? When you read them as an adult, you're like, whoa, we would tell these stories to children? That feels a little much.
Mm-hmm. Do we think that he inspired Frozen? Because like
I was going to say, Annie, I was surprised that you didn't think of him as having Olaf vibes as well.
Olaf, too. I have that in my notes.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been impaled. Like when his body like fell off.
He kind of made me think of Eeyore. I don't know. He's just all sad and
depressed. That is fair. Yeah. He does have a little bit of a vibe like that. I mean, granted, like.
The legs vibe.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh were, like, I think those books started being published around this era, as well as the books were happening. Like,
oh,
they're quite
go.
Old as well. I think there might have been a little bit after the Oz books, but with that, yeah, it's possible that there was, like, a little bit in there as well. Anyway, this is the weird, it's so funny to see this versus, like, the original cast of characters. This is like the Timu cast of characters that
Timu
you get.
Wizard of Oz. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you're like, oh, we have the substitutes for everything. So like, here is, you know, Jack Pumpkinhead's our scarecrow, and here is our Tin Man substitute in TikTok. And I guess the Gump is supposed to be the lion,
which is a
weird choice. But nevertheless, it's just like that. And obviously, Belina is meant to be like your Toto equivalent because she's the only one who comes.
But then they had the characters in the at the end of the movie anyways.
Correct. Yeah. It wasn't like an IT. It's like they don't exist. I know that the design of the characters in this film, of like the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and like the lion, particularly the Scarecrow and the Tin Man, I know like look a lot more like the illustrations, I think, from earlier times of what the characters were meant to look like. But it really bothered me. Not the Tin Man. The Tin Man looked kind of cute, actually. I thought he was adorable. He was like a little bit goofy looking, but the Scarecrow really bothered me that he wasn't just a person with face paint, so he couldn't emote, and I hated that a little bit.
It's something to do with copyright as well, because MGM had the rights to the Wizard of Oz and the depictions of the characters the way they showed it, whereas the book is, you know, it's open season on the book, and
yeah,
they paid MGM for the ruby slippers because yes. that is not in the book. In the book, it's silver slippers.
Oh,
okay.
So they couldn't have they the wouldn't have been able to exactly use the same. Apparently MGM was like, she will not be in a gingham dress, like that's our version,
and she's not, so that's fine.
No, she's basically in Samantha's dress, the America Girl doll.
Oh,
she's dressed like exactly like Samantha.
I never had dolls growing up, they creeped me out.
I never had American Girl dolls growing up either, until Caroline gave me her old one because I was jealous.
My old two, actually. Yes. Samantha and Felicity.
Yeah.
Nice. So,
and then my son cut their fucking hair.
Oh my God.
La la la. I didn't hear that.
There's the rest you, of the horror
you, I
story.
I kept that a secret for you, from you for like 6 months because I was so ashamed. And I have told you, maybe you blocked it out, but
there's the rest of the horror.
Yeah. Thank goodness my mother already is dead.
she would have killed her. the story basically follows Dorothy trying to restore Oz after it has been taken over by this gnome king who pretty much lives under the mountain. That felt very Tolkien to me, who pretty much lives under the mountain and apparently was the one who was the original proprietor of all of the emeralds in Emerald City and feels that they have been stolen and has like lain waste to most of Oz and the Emerald City and is now trying to take everything over. There's some
cool... He's an environmentalist.
That's what I wrote. I wrote, is this movie environmentalist propaganda?
He is an interesting character. I love all the claymation stuff that happens towards the end of the film during like all of like the sort of final confrontations. That's really
great. The character design of it. Yeah.
He was also a little bit fabulous with those ruby slippers. Oh yeah,
kind of building the entry to his climate room.
Yeah, the hands that were like prying open like the stone. That was cool. I really liked that. And I love how fabulous he is with his ruby slippers on. I was like, oh okay, gnome king.
You really got that on us with that one. Yeah,
really.
I think you know, we need to learn from this. If you are making a Faustian deal with a supernatural being, like get your terms right. Like just double check. He was like, there will be a risk involved and they don't ask
what it is. No, because, you know, they're a child and a tin being with no feelings, which they make very clear over and over again. I'm not alive and I don't want to be alive.
Moose who wants to die.
And a moose head who wants to die. And, you know, a pumpkin head that keeps falling off of a little like.
She's just not in good company to make decisions.
Correct.
Because that's the first thing I thought of. I'm like, what? Tell me everything that can go wrong. Yes. I want it signed.
Yeah, but you're thinking about this from like the perspective of somebody in their mid-30s. Like, it's not the same thing.
If she had Auntie M with her, she would have gotten the terms.
Probably, yes.
Yeah,
there would have been clarification. So, with all of this happening, Annie, on rewatch, I want to know, because we've talked about like the things that were traumatic to you in watching the movie. On rewatch, how do you feel about it now through like a different lens years later?
I still like it because I think it kind of holds up as an artifact of what it was like to be an 80s child. So I think it's truer to the books and it's, I like dark stuff. So I really love it. But before we move on to the peanut butter solution, we really haven't discussed Princess Mombi enough. Can we go back to her for just 100%. A couple minutes?
So I think she might have been maybe within Oz itself, maybe the most like horror particular aspect of it, because all of those heads that wake up and talk and things were fucking
terrifying.
That's
what I thought was going to be one of the childhood horrors or traumas, I guess, is that all those heads, they just look at you and then she switches heads.
Yeah.
Terrifying. So
she's like Elizabeth Bathory. She's a serial killer, right? She's collecting trophies.
She does have a distinctive Elizabeth Bathory vibe, doesn't she? She's just like, she might not be bathing in blood, but she is collecting heads, and that's weird.
She's keeping aging at bay with the suffering, through the suffering of young women.
Yeah. Between that, her voice, just the general way that like Jean Marsh kind of conducts herself when she's playing the character in general, she does a great job because you're just like petrified of her the entire time, whether she's Nurse Wilson or Princess Mombi, really.
Yeah, all her heads are scary. I don't understand the why the heads scream. Like, why are they on her side if they've been
no idea
taken? But yeah, when that's in that Powder of Life scene, when she's sneaking through the sleeping giant scene, you know,
like
both of these movies have sleeping giant scenes as well. You know, having to sneak past a bad guy, not knowing, are they really asleep?
Mm-hmm.
And then the crazy eyes of Jean Marsh like pop open and she starts screaming. Like, that is horror.
It is. It's really scary.
That was bad.
Yeah.
And she's like, didn't she chase her without a head or something?
There was the body at one point like comes up and like zombies towards her. And you're like, my God, this really is a horror movie, isn't it? I can definitely see all of the aspects of why, like, if you watched this as a young child, you would have been pretty terrified of it, honestly. Yeah.
If you could decapitate a famous person and keep their head, who would you choose?
What am I keeping the head for?
Yeah.
to look hot, right?
Like, put it on your head? Oh, like to put it on your body? Ooh.
Or to look
not
hot myself?
Not to, like, keep in your fridge. It's not to Ed Kemper it. I mean, like, to, you know, just if you could swap heads.
Oh, my God.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
I knew you were going to say Michelle Pfeiffer.
Henry Cavill? Cool guy.
That's a generic choice, but okay.
That is a great choice.
Thank you.
I respect that choice.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'd go like Ingrid Bergman.
Ooh, interesting. Oh, okay. If we can go with people who are dead, there might be different choices.
Ingrid Bergman in her Casablanca days, not like when she was nearly dead.
if we're looking at that, I don't know, maybe like Katherine Hepburn or something. Anyway, choices.
Yeah, so and the other, I think, scary thing that really got me, and this is something that I struggle with in other, well, like, for example, have you ever read Stephen King's The Jaunt?
No.
Not The Jaunt.
It's a short story, and it's this kind of existential horror of being trapped forever.
Okay.
In something. And, you know, so just this horror of being turned into a tchotchke, basically, and stuck there. Like, are you conscious in this? Or are you Han Solo? Are you unconscious? Like, you know, so what is the experience of those people who are turned into ornaments? And are you aware of it? And I found that really, really scary as a kid. Like, if you were potentially aware of your scenario and just stuck there.
I'm really impressed that you had the wherewithal to think
about
that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you thought about that.
I've always been scared of that.
I would never have thought of that. I think when I was a kid, I would have been scared of all of the other aspects that we've spoken about, whether it's the electroshock stuff, the Wheelers, Princess Mombi herself, even the Gnome King, like, to a degree.
Eating, like, his jaw,
that was really scary.
Like, dislocating so that he can eat these characters. That's pretty scary too, with like hellfire behind him.
Yes. It's very hellish.
you just made me think of, have you guys watched the Black Mirror episodes?
Yeah.
Some of them.
That's very Black Mirror.
Yeah. With the whole thing of like your consciousness gets put into the device and you can experience 100 years in 30 seconds.
Which that's episode is fucked. That?
White Christmas.
White Christmas is one of them.
Yes, the one on him.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
horrifies me.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would not know.
That's probably my favorite Black Mirror episode.
It's a good one.
It's a really good one.
Yeah,
what's the other one? There's one. Oh no, Good People.
Which one is Good People? Was that from that last season?
Yes.
I'm never watching that episode.
Yeah, I know the one that traumatized you.
Nope, I'm never watching that episode again.
This is your adult trauma?
Oh yeah, it was. I burst into tears in the middle of it, and
it was bad.
So it was really upsetting.
You guys seen that one? Then yeah,
I don't know what happens. Season. I've only seen like a smattering of episodes.
A couple that, you know, they're whatever in their 30s or something like this, and they get into a car accident, and the wife basically kind of like loses brain function.
Yeah,
but she's still alive, and in order to bring her back out of the coma, whatever it is, there's like this experimental thing that can be put into her brain, which is essentially a device that kind of Okay. So yeah, so that it kind of brings the brain back alive, and it's a subscription model, of course. And then as it progresses, it gets more expensive. And since teachers gets taken away, like she can't leave the county, you have to pay more for that. And if you don't pay for that, you just blur out ads without you knowing that you've done it. And then it's all the other things that they both have to do in order to pay that subscription that ends up being like thousands of dollars a month in order to just for her to live. It's absolutely wild.
It's, I think part of the horror of it is that it feels like true to life in the sense of what would happen in the sort of like, you know, like monetization of doing something like helping people in like healthcare and things like that.
Absolutely.
So scary. Get there. So
scary. And then San Junipero is very
I love that one.
Right. That one's great.
I love that one.
That's my favorite one I've watched.
Like, these are just, they're just code. They're just chips. And it has that slight allusion to the darkness of all the people who are going to the really dark, like kind of sadomasochistic club because they want to feel something. And it's like, okay, this is kind of,
but we also have this
romance,
this beautiful sapphic love story between these two women.
Yeah.
Like, happy at the end. You're like, yay, that's all I'm going to focus on.
Happy for now. And then we are dropped. What happens 300 years from now?
Yeah.
300 years from now.
We just don't think about that. And it's the same. There are a few
like, I think about that.
Happier episodes. There's a few happier episodes. That one, there's that other episode about like having a set amount of time with people. Hang the DJ, I think.
I think so.
But there's like a couple that
The simulation one?
An app. It's like a simulation app or whatever, but you only have like X amount of time and you don't know what it is ahead of time and stuff like that. That one's actually really sweet. But there are very few hopeful episodes of that show.
No. Yeah.
It's a pretty pessimistic show.
Correct.
So how many, Carolyn, did you make your kids watch this? I made mine.
I made them.
I still have a 7-year-old. No.
Well, that's probably when I saw it. I mean, why not, you know, then maybe your 7-year-old will someday be a weirdo like us. Don't you want
that? Yeah. Caroline, fuck up your kids. Come on now.
No, I did not.
Yeah, my daughter basically heckled it the whole time and she was very upset that Dorothy didn't look like Dorothy. She was like, why is she younger? And she kind of flounced about halfway through.
Oh,
and
really? Okay.
My son stayed and was like, okay, I'm interested. But he didn't seem traumatized. But then, you know, these guys have seen like Stranger Things. Like they've seen Breaking Bones. So like they didn't find it scary.
Fair. Mm-hmm. And it's so different, you know, what, 40 years later to a different kind of audience,
you're
right?
So desensitized.
Honestly, so the pacing of this movie is a little bit off. Like it was a little bit long-winded, I found, during certain portions.
Yeah.
I think you could have cut a good 20 to 30 minutes off of it because it's almost 2 hours long, which felt unnecessary. But I enjoyed it because I don't even think I mentioned it at the top of the episode, but both of the films that we're talking about today are first-time watches for both of us. Mm-hmm. So I was curious as to like how I would feel about this because Return to Oz is one of those films that I've been aware of for a long time, but I just never got around to watching it. It wasn't something that was really on TV when I was a kid, but I was born in 89. So it's possible that it just kind of passed me by a little bit because of that. And I just kind of never got around, or maybe it was just not on TV here. I have no idea. So I never got around to watching it. So
maybe
it was
Canada
cool.
was too nice to air.
They were like, hey, whoa, we don't do that shit to our kids.
Yeah.
But I think there was also just more actual child programming when you were growing up than when we were.
Quite possibly. Yeah. I think they had started maybe to kind of be like, oh, hey, we should be careful about what we're showing kids. Like, you know, by like the mid to late 90s, they were like, let's just.
I think that these movies are like older than Nickelodeon, you know, and older than maybe the Disney Channel was around. I'm not sure.
I don't know if the Disney Channel was around in the 80s. I'd have to look that up. I'm not sure.
It definitely was in the 80s, but I think maybe late. We got the cable when I was like 6, and the first thing I ever watched on cable was Dumbo's Circus on the Disney Channel.
Oh, okay.
So that would have been like 88, maybe? Yeah.
Okay, could have been a little later.
Anyway.
I don't know. Anyway, I enjoyed this film overall. I will say, other than the length of it, honestly, overall, I enjoyed it. Maybe it's because it has a darker tone than the original movie.
Oh, 100%.
I don't know, but I liked it.
How many beautiful severed heads would you give it out of 5?
I'd be at like a 3, I think.
Me too.
Yeah, something like that. 3? Yeah, it's solid. Solid one.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. All right, we're moving on to our batshit crazy selection from this because we really have a conversation about this. One, because it, again, it's a wild movie that makes no sense. And two, because I cannot believe that I have never heard of it, never seen it, never anythinged it this entire time and didn't even realize, we went in totally blind, did not realize what this was until we started the opening credits of the film.
What
and then
kind
I got
of
real
Canadians are you?
Honestly. Mm-hmm. And it's not even just that we're Canadian. We're Canadian from the place that these movies
from are. Montreal.
Yeah.
We are from the area. So I don't understand this.
There were scenes that I'm like, I know this place. I know this place.
Oh, we're going to talk about it a little bit. There are a couple of specific scenes that we need to point out because we found the entire movie there, the outdoor shots. We were like, what neighborhood is this in? Where is this? Mm-hmm. And we were picking out where they were located. And it's very weird to see my city 40 years ago and to see very big, like stark differences, but also similarities to certain things that I'm like, oh shit. Yeah, that's still there.
Yeah, you know what, I can't wait. You know, you did the synopsis of the other movie so well, and I just can't wait to see you try to
no
do that.
There's no synopsis for this movie. Okay. Background for this film, which is called The Peanut Butter Solution, or Opération Beurre de Peanut, if you're very Quebecer about it. Thank you. I did grow up here, so... is part of a series of films, again, none of which I have watched, which I'm flabbergasted by as somebody who was born here as well. This is part of an entire series of films consisting of 27 entries to date.
27?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Called Tales for All or Contes pour Tous, which is basically they're a series of children's films, essentially, some of which are in English, some of which are in French. It sort of seems to vary depending on the director, the writer, whatever the tale itself might actually be. And my vague kind of takeaway is that they're meant to be stories that have a message of some sort. After this movie, I really shudder to wonder what the fucking message is. I don't know. But this is the second film in the franchise, and my understanding is both a theatrical and a TV release, which is also mm-hmm. fascinating to me. I'm like, this was released in theaters. Stop it. Can you imagine taking your kid to see this?
It's a great movie. Like
oh, so good.
How many cans of peanut butter out of 5?
It's like a question mark. I don't even know if I can give it a rating. It's so weird.
It's 4.
It's shut up.
I can't eat that many jars of peanut butter, but it's definitely 4.
Oh God. Okay. So as mentioned, this movie was released in 1985 as well. It's very weird basic plot is that it follows an 11-year-old boy named Michael who visits some sort of alleged abandoned haunted house. One
was burned down.
Yes.
Just recently.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And apparently it's haunted because of that.
Yeah.
Well,
because the winos were inside. True.
We learn why later because the homeless people, unfortunately, the unhoused people were killed in the fire, which that's dark. There's a horror movie in and of itself. So he visits the haunted house with his best friend one day and experiences a quote-unquote fright.
Yes.
Which we only kind of vaguely learn what that is a little bit late, like right at the end of the film. We don't see the fright happen. We only see his hair stand on end because he's so scared that he turns into a cartoon character. Mm-hmm. He then goes home, wakes up the next morning, and all of his hair has fallen out and seemingly will not grow back until... he is visited by the ghosts of the two people who gave him the fright at the abandoned mansion, who give him the grossest recipe I've ever heard in my entire life to put on his head in, as like a paste, essentially, to create from all sorts of household items to grow his hair back. He doesn't listen to, because of the consistency of it, he does not listen to or heed their advice about how many teaspoons of peanut butter, tablespoons of peanut butter. He's meant
maybe
to put...
this is another lesson. You know, we maybe. Said if you are making
follow instructions,
a supernatural being, get the terms right.
Follow instructions.
Also, follow instructions.
Yeah.
Like
the moral of the story is follow instructions.
Don't let the cat sleep on your head. Yeah. That's what happened.
I have a story about that. A cat sleeping on heads.
Oh, we're gonna talk.
All right, well, wait. We gotta finish the synopsis first.
Okay. When we get to cats sleeping on heads, I have something really important to say.
Okay. So, as people with two cats, I'm curious to hear this. So, when he disregards the advice that he's given from the ghosts and he adds 5 tablespoons instead of 1 tablespoon of peanut butter to the recipe, what this causes to happen is for his hair to grow back at an exponential rate and never, ever, ever stop growing. So it quickly turns into a very weird problem, and then.
On top of that,
an opportunistic kidnapper / art teacher in the area decides to capitalize on this problem and kidnaps not just Michael, but multiple children from the neighborhood.
Everyone.
And create a sweatshop in which Michael's hair is used to produce paintbrushes. What the fuck is this fucking movie? Just saying,
before that part happened, I was like, if I was in his position, what would I would do? I'm like, there's a monetization opportunity right there.
Were you talking about the teacher?
No, about Michael, before the teacher thing happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, you for sure can make money out of this. And then the teacher come up and like, this guy.
Yeah, but smart. You had like a normal idea, which was like start a wig business. I was like, yes.
Are you sure you're not American?
He's only been here for like 26 years. Fine. So that is like the overarching plot of the film. It's so incredibly strange. It's also weird to me that this is like a kid's film because it does have like some really strange stuff going on in it. I was listening to the podcast How Did This Get Made did an episode about this movie.
I was re-listening to that episode today, but a while back.
So they did this like, I don't know, like in 2020 or something. They had an episode about this, and I was listening to this earlier today actually, and I do have only one bone of contention from like, because they're just, you know, going through the movie and making fun of it, which totally makes sense. I have one bone of contention, which is the co-host, what's her name, Diane Raphael, who co-hosts the podcast. She makes a comment towards the beginning of the episode about the fact that every single character in this film has a French Canadian accent. That's incorrect. They don't.
No, absolutely not.
I can't tell what accent Signor and his brothers, apparently.
They're supposed to be Italian.
All different accents. It's insane.
He did not sound Italian.
No, they're all poor, very, very poor Italian accents, but they're definitely not French Canadian. None of the lead characters have an accent that sounds French Canadian at all in any capacity. There are a few side characters here and there. A couple of the other kids do. But
what
outside of that,
did the doctor have?
The doctor.
He was supposed to be German, I thought.
Yeah, he was. Okay, but he's also one of the brothers because they're all brothers.
I know, but
apparently.
His name is like Epstein.
I don't know. It doesn't make sense. I don't think it's supposed to, if we're honest. I think it's supposed to be weird on purpose, I would guess. So,
when we go camping, we do this thing around the campfire where we tell stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody does a sentence.
We do that.
And,
you know,
when you add like a 10-year-old boy into that, the story immediately gets bonkers. And this is what this felt like to me. Like, nothing that came before made sense with what came after. It was just like, oh, and then this could happen. And, yeah, it just felt like it was written by children.
Yes, it did.
That makes much more sense than someone writing this while being high or something. I don't know how it happened.
I don't know. I mean, apparently it was written by 1, 2, 3, 4 people, including the director, Michael Rubo.
Well, that's what happened.
Yeah,
they wrote a little bit and then they gave the script and they're like, and then this happened.
Yeah.
When I Googled Tales for All, Google said back, a highly celebrated, generation-defining series of Canadian children's films spanning over 24 family-friendly, non-violent features, the series has won over 200 international awards.
Wow. Family-friendly.
Family-friendly. I know. Family-friendly is a weird choice for a guy kidnapping a bunch of kids.
Caroline, what was scariest about this for you? Like, you said this was...
Set your scene. Pretty, please tell us how you watched this film, Amish.
Yeah, okay, so let's... But yeah, so essentially, I grew up going to the summer like family vacation home of these family friends of ours that we had all our holidays together and everything. And their family vacation home was on Lake Winnipesaukee, which is in New Hampshire and very near the Maine border. So you do get a lot of like Canada radio, Canada TV and stuff like that. And this would have been, I would have been like 5 or 6 probably. And they did not have cable. So whatever we were watching was just on the TV.
Right.
And they did have a Nintendo. I played a ton of Paperboy, but like, anyway, they were watching this movie and this family had one kid my age and two kids like 7 and 9 years older than me. My brother's 8 years older than me. So these like older kids put this movie on and they were all laughing and everything. And I was also like this is really embarrassing, but when I was little, like there was one person, my mom would always tell the story. There was one person who like stopped me and was like, oh, your little girl. So like, she's got, look at her big blue eyes and whatever. And they complimented me on stuff being cute. And then I was like, hair, like you didn't compliment my hair. Cause I had this really long hair for my age.
Yeah.
And I felt very attached to my hair as my value. Right. Like, so first watching him lose all of his hair was like really traumatized. I was like, oh my God, if I lost all my hair, what would I do? You know, it's like the most important part of me is my hair. and it was like a nightmare. And then kids were teasing him. And then when he had, and then the art teacher, I also like hated being yelled at by anyone in authority. The art teacher is so mean, you know, he's like a giant bully being like, imagination. No, you can't have imagination in art. And,
yeah.
And then he gets kidnapped and he's like, you know, in this sweatshop situation. And that, and meanwhile, the art teacher is wearing his hair as a jacket.
Terrifying.
And his dog has a little hair jacket too.
Oh my God. I saw that later. I was like, oh my God, Jim has a little fucking fur vest on. It's terrible. Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, this is worse. And then throughout my childhood, I had recurring nightmares where that senor would be in my nightmares. Like he would come in my dreams with his hair jacket and like try to kidnap me to make my hair into paintbrushes.
The hair jacket is horrifying.
Right?
It's giving like Ed Gein.
Yes. Yeah, it does. It's not a skin suit, but like it's close, guy.
Yeah.
It was just haute couture. It's okay.
It's a fur coat.
Yuck. Yeah. This movie was insane. I think I was also just, we were just flabbergasted because we've never heard of any of these films. We've never seen any of them. And, you know, that was exactly what happened. We were watching the movie and there's a scene towards the beginning of the film that in which a character walks out of the bank and it's a TD Bank and it's on the same corner that it still is on to this day. We were like, that's still a TD.
It's still a TD Bank.
Yeah. It's 41 years later after this movie came out. Yeah. It's still there.
Crazy.
Yep. And there were multiple different scenes like their house. I'm looking at their house. I'm like, oh, I know where
their house is gorgeous.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
I mean, I don't know how they have whatever the mom does for work. Cause there's nobody, the dad is making money for that house with his shit art. Like that art is so bad. Like the badminton painting is the worst one.
It's so bad. And they're like beautiful. And I'm like,
it's like I could sell this.
Yeah.
Looks like a teenager did it. Like they were just like, this is my art project.
In movies and TV shows where somebody's like an artist or a musician and they actually show the poem or the art or the song and it's so bad.
And it's like, bad. And you're like, yeah. This was my bone of contention with How Did This Get Made was like the dad in particular. I'm like, this man has the most Ontario accent of anyone I've ever heard in my life. And I was like, this is not a French Canadian person at all. And I checked and I'm like, no, he's from Ontario.
Yeah. No, I recognized him from, he was also in Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
Yep. Which my husband watched like obsessively.
Canada has a lot of sci-fi filming here for some reason, especially in the 90s and early 2000s. I don't know why.
Do you think that like Toni Collette, he should get an Oscar for destroying his studio and her, you know, like Hereditary? She destroys her studio and then he's like so anguished. But then when he discovers like who has his child, he's like, oh, so he doesn't come back until Friday and it's Tuesday. Yeah. I guess I'll just wait.
The level of nonchalance that the adults in this film have about things. The doctor, when the kid loses his hair, like, oh, look at that. You've lost your hair. I'm like,
oh yeah. The medical term is harem scarum. I'm like, that's not a medical term.
That was
which also sounds made up by children. Harem scarum. Like a kid made this up.
That's it.
And also to the point that you were making earlier, Annie, I was like, there's no way a cat sitting on someone's head would do this. You know?
It would.
No, well, okay, it wouldn't.
Make you lose
Can I tell you my cat story?
Please.
Did you end up bald?
Not me. But a cat. So my cousin was a little kid and she kept coming, you know, home and her mom would notice that her hair had been cut. And she was like, are you cutting your hair at school? Is someone cutting your hair at school? Are you getting bullied? And she was like, no, I'm not doing anything to my hair. And then one day she walked into her bedroom while her daughter was sleeping and saw the cat sitting on her pillow eating her hair.
So, okay.
What?
That happened. Not bald. Okay. You would need more time for that, but
not that I've had cats my whole life. I've never heard of that happening. However, they do love to chew like the string from balloons and stuff like that. So I'm not shocked that they would chew on hair, but you wouldn't end up like Mr. Clean, you know?
No,
not end up bald. Yeah.
No, ours will chew on like shoelaces and stuff.
Yeah.
Wires, assholes. They're the worst.
Can I ask why were the dad and Susie or Suze always sneaking up on him. Like when they get him a wig, instead of being just like, hey, we got you this wig.
Let's
would you
try
like to
this
try
wig.
They literally like sneak up on him and like wrestle the wig on him.
It's
and
for it's your like, own good. And you're like,
there's no reason for this.
Also, I would like to know, so both of you are mothers, so I would very much like your perspective as to like having your son lose all of his hair and something horrible happening to him, and nobody calls mom. No one calls her in Australia to tell her what's going on.
I thought the mom was dead at the beginning.
Me too. And then I was like, oh, she's just in Australia. All right, cool. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, I think she's in Australia.
She was dead. And then a kid came around the campfire and told the next part of the story and was like, actually, she's in Australia.
Because her dad died.
She was in Australia because she had a parent who died. And she had to like deal with their estate. But like, there is long distance calling. You know, like my mother was from a foreign country. She definitely spoke to relatives in the 80s, even when we had long distance calling, you know?
Yes, like even when you had to pay for that kind of thing, like it was still something that would happen on a regular basis. It's so incredibly bizarre that they're like, you know, Suze is like, should we call mom? And Michael's like, I want to call mom. Like, I would like to speak to my mother. And he's just kind of like, no. And I'm like, are you worried she's going to think you're incompetent? Like, what is the issue?
That's what it is. It's definitely the dad being like, I can fix it before she comes back.
Yeah. It's giving like a madcap comedy.
Suze was fixing everything.
Yeah. Like toxic masculinity. Hello.
Yeah, like, a middle-aged mom who's had it up to here. Like,
oh yeah. No. Suze is like, we were looking at her haircut.
And how old is she?
I don't understand. 12. She's like a year like older than him. Yeah.
Why is she not going to school the same time as he is?
I don't know.
And why is she doing their taxes or whatever?
I know she's doing their finances. At one point, she got a little calculator. I was like, what's happening right now? How incompetent is their father?
Well, she looks so annoyed when she gets interrupted because, like, she's doing really important household admin.
I mean, I would be annoyed too. I'm the only adult in the house, you know?
Pretty much. Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's so weird. She's like, she has the vibe of like a 45-year-old woman who's like, oh, I need a smoke. I've seen some shit. Like, it's it's so funny to see. And then we have the contrast of like Michael, who turns into a whiny little bitch boy after his hair falls out for a while. He really got on my nerves. And Connie, who is a much nicer friend than he needs to be, really.
Yeah, can we talk about why Connie wanted pubes?
Oh my God.
I don't really understand that.
Is that a thing that boys want when they're kids? Is that something that they want? You're the only one who can answer this question. Please tell me.
You're really on the spot here.
I guess. You're just like, oh, I'm manly now. Like, I don't know.
Maybe. That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, is it like growing chest hair or something? Is it supposed to mean you're like a man now?
Sure.
Okay.
Except no one can see it, but you know.
I mean, no, but you know, like a self-satisfaction, I guess. That's important.
It's weird. I don't know. It's
I cannot imagine.
The tension of not knowing what, like, they really like took a while to like tell us whether or not the peanut butter solution worked on his pubes.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
They showed a lot of restraint, actually, and like really making us wait, because I was like, what is going on with that? And then they just dropped it.
Oh my God.
Well, that's the thing. They do just drop it because he's able to do all this like MacGyver stuff, like in the sweatshop, and his pubes aren't coming out of his pants anymore. Like, I don't understand. The hair kept growing. Like, why wouldn't it?
Like, Michael's hair is growing, so feasibly Connie's.
And to your point on how did this get made, June Diane Raphael does make the good point that the pubes would not look like that coming out of the pants.
No, that doesn't. No.
The texture is not correct.
At all. They're like, it's like long, like straight hair. And I'm like, that's a little bit weird, but
they make great magic paintbrushes.
Can you?
I think another piece of advice that we can learn is don't put untested solution on your junk.
Yeah,
that just feels like a poor choice.
That is just general life advice.
It should be
for everyone.
Be common sense for everybody forever. Don't put anything untested down there. It's a bad idea. You don't know what will happen. This feels like the tip of the iceberg of how bad it could have been, really.
Yeah. I felt like Connie was really mumbling. I don't know if it was just my hearing, but like the whole vibe of it felt like kids acting in a home video, like the type of thing you made with other neighborhood kids.
Oh my God.
And I was like, someone tell these kids to enunciate. And
there's a lot of that I find in the early scenes with conversations between Michael and Suze. The two of them, I was just kind of like, this is very made for TV.
It has a total made for TV vibe.
Public access vibes for sure.
Yeah.
Very much. That between that, the three brothers who are allegedly related and do not have the same accent, none of them have the same accent, which is incredibly confusing. There's the doctor, the art dealer, and the teacher. slash kidnapper. Yes. They're all brothers, apparently. According to something I was reading online, apparently the dead Wino was also supposed to be one of their brothers. And I was like, wait, what?
Stop it.
Yeah.
What?
And I was
everyone in this town, is everyone in Montreal related?
They're sure not, but it feels like it in this movie. It feels like, it, but really they make it seem like 500 people live on the island of Montreal. Jesus. I'm like, there's like over a million people here. I don't think you can get away.
Every single person you know is a brother. Again, yes. Sounds like a kid was like, and guess what? They're all brothers.
Yeah. Just for fun. Yeah, I guess, because it's fine. This was bonkers, batshit bananas. I think by the time it gets to the final scenes in the factory that he's keeping all of the kids in, where he's forcing them to work in the sweatshop, for really, like, he's getting away with it for no reason, because, like, there are so many children in there that could overpower him easily, and that's very confusing. Also, I'm like,
I thought they should have gone all weapons on him.
Agreed. That's what I said in the middle of the movie. I was like, what, have you not seen weapons? You guys could take care of this. It's a bigger group.
Caroline, well, have you seen weapons?
No, but also when they paint the scene and he goes in and he's like going to the house, I'm like, all of you just walk into that painting now and walk away. Like, this is your door.
Yes, because they say so specifically
weird in that scene.
Yeah, I know.
It is. He starts like kind of like playing it up and dancing around, and he's like, oh, I'm getting some audience reaction here.
Yeah, I guess that's what he wants really more than anything.
Does he just want to be a father? Because when Connie pretends, he's like, you can be my father because my father died in a plane crash. Is that true? Yeah.
Which is a lie. No, because he's just like, later when one of the other kids is like, did your dad really die? He's like, shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple things. That was really smart. And then the whole like sugar thing was really smart.
Oh,
like, these are some actually really good plans.
I would not have running around that whole scene.
Except they basically gave Connie to the kidnapper.
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, the street sweeper was there and the sugar. Different. But otherwise, I felt like that was, smart.
It was clever because I didn't understand why they had sugar in a funnel for the whole first time until he got in the truck. I was like, why is he carrying a bag of sugar? What's going on? And then finally you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, they are trying.
It's kid's logic.
Yeah, no, I don't know. But see, that's why it feels like it was written by a child.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is so weird. This entire movie feels like it shouldn't exist, but I'm also kind of glad that it does just because of how funny it is, like how ridiculous the story is.
It's like watching Sharknado.
Yeah. Yes. And like sense. The acting doesn't suit the tension in any scene basically at all. It's either too much or too little, depending on what's happening at any given time. It's really weird that, the kids are like all over the place. The storyline there's a through line, but it's like a very weird, very sketchy through line of a plot that you're just sort of like, what is this? And then again, these feel like they're supposed to be films that are teaching some sort of lesson, but outside of listen to instructions, I cannot.
Well, but it's not even telling that story well, because if they were listening to instructions, then Connie wouldn't have been like, if you yell at me, I'm not going to come back to your class. Like, they yell at the art teacher. They don't listen to him,
Did you have bad vibes about the art teacher, like from that class?
Yes.
So I was like, this guy is handsy with these children.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I did not like him. Well, that was what I was saying in the middle of it, right? I'm looking, I'm like, man, you are not allowed to touch kids like this now in the classroom.
Thank God now, He did love his dog.
He did. Maybe Jim is his one redeeming quality.
Good dogs happen to bad people all the time.
Buffalo Bill loved his dog too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And look how that turned out. I just listened to your guys' episode about Silence of the Lambs.
I think we shout you out in Silence of the Lambs because we have no idea when we're releasing that. Did we mention that we were doing this?
We don't know when this is coming out. So sorry, everybody.
Yeah.
Sometime this summer. I don't know. These were really fun just because I think of how over the top they were. And I think what I mentioned earlier in the episode was just the fact that this is the first time that our childhood trauma is actual films that are technically for children.
Right. Intended to be traumatic.
No.
I'm glad you're okay with that, because I was having a little bit of like, should I have chosen a real horror movie? I was shame spiraling a little bit, like if this was a good choice. So I'm glad you guys enjoyed them.
I think that there are still enough horrific elements in these films, especially like on rewatch, watching it in like a modern lens where you can kind of take that and roll with it. But yeah, anyway, I guess to wrap it up, Caroline, watching this now from your perspective, how do you feel about this movie?
I mean, it is batshit, like you said. Like I was shocked watching it at how unthreatening it actually is, you know, because it's so ridiculous.
I'm not sinister. You're like,
I mean, that man terrorized my dreams for like years.
Oh my God.
You know, like I remember being on vacation at like Arizona with my family and waking up screaming in the night because I thought he was in the room.
Oh no. Oh God. He was your sleep paralysis demon.
He was.
I'm surprised because I thought when I was like, what scared Caroline about this? I thought it was going to be the wino, Mary, one of the wino
girls.
I
didn't even remember about the fright whatsoever. Honestly, all I remembered was he loses all his hair, horrifying. His hair starts growing back uncontrollably and he gets kidnapped and his hair gets made into paintbrushes. And both of those things were like torturing me.
The paintbrushes idea is wild. That's like one of the craziest things I've ever
seen.
Maybe
it's an anti-capitalist message.
Maybe.
Oh yeah. So the paintbrushes, by the way, Annie, classic to me. I did look up a $20 paintbrush in 1985 in Canadian dollars would be $52.53 Canadian today.
That's pretty expensive.
For one paintbrush.
Pretty expensive
for one paintbrush.
Yeah.
But they were magic paintbrushes.
Which you had like no cost other than those like outfits, which by the way, we were just talking about this. Like easily you could find who's kidnapped 20 of our children recently. Like, I don't know, who's been buying 20 nurses' outfits for children?
Yeah, that's it. Who's bought like child size scrubs?
Right.
They look like they've been run through the wash with a red sock, like Paddington, too.
Yeah.
Like they were like in these white little outfits. But they are really that weird, like off pink salmon color that you're like, this just looks like somebody stuck a red sock in with a load of whites.
Did you feel like there was something Roald Dahl absurd about this?
It felt very witches, you know?
Yeah.
Like the adults.
Well, going into a painting.
The
girl is trapped in the painting and the witches.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. And like just like kids being observant of adults doing sinister, weird things that they can't quite figure out what they are until they're sort of already kind of implicated in it as well. Yeah, it does have kind of a bit of a Roald Dahl quality to it. Maybe that was part of the inspiration for the story.
There were two Breaking Bad things it reminded me of.
Oh my gosh.
Connie's hat is very much like the black hat.
Oh yes, he does have like a Heisenberg hat on at some point.
And when Senor loses his hair, I thought he looked like him.
Oh yes, I actually wrote that down as well. Walter White. Frank he looks Kristen, like Walter White. But one thing actually. So did you recognize the singing voice? I know you listened to that.
This was my other fact. That I'm looking through information about this, and then it was like this is the first film to feature English language songs by Celine Dion, and I was like, no, it's not.
So that's iconic.
And there are two in the movie. Mm. One of them towards the climax, and then the other one during like the closing scene, closing credits of the film. And it's very early Celine Dion because you can only kind of hear it when she hits high notes.
Yeah.
Because she would have been quite young in 1985.
And she's singing like nonsense.
Yeah,
I think she's a teenager.
She would have been a kid. She was probably like 16 or 17. When she did this, but she would have been like a child at the time.
The music was crazy because at one point there's piano music that I thought reminded me just a touch of Twin Peaks.
Sure.
And then there's these melodramatic ballads from her.
Yes.
And so it was just all this tonal erratic inconsistency in both these films, whether we compare Return to Oz and Wizard of Oz, and just the tonal inconsistency from scene to scene in this.
Yep. Yeah. Right?
Utter fever dream, both of them.
Completely. But so fun to so fun to watch now because you can dissect them in a completely different way, which I always appreciate.
Yeah, thank you for giving me a reason because I have asked, I don't know how many people I've asked, have you ever seen this movie? And Annie knows we have one friend.
Okay.
It's the spouse of a friend of ours from college who he and I was like, oh my God, you've seen this too. And we talked about it forever, but I've literally only met one other person who'd seen it.
Well, this was a first for me. I hadn't seen it or heard of it.
Gosh.
More people need to see it.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe we're putting that out into the world. I'm sure that How Did This Get Made probably would get a little more traction with that. But if you haven't watched it, you know what? Just check it out just for fun.
We need to evangelize these movies.
That's it.
Yes, exactly. So that more people watch them. And if you haven't seen Return to Oz, honestly, give it a shot because it's worth seeing.
Yeah, have a Tales for All marathon this Christmas or whatever.
I'm seriously considering watching whatever the latest one is that's come out that was out in 2025 because it's called My Stepmother is a Witch. And I was like, oh,
cool.
Okay.
That's it would be title. Interesting to see if they're trying to kind of keep the same vibe as this or if they're like updating it.
In
you know, because
capacity.
For example, with the Sharknado movies, have you ever watched beyond the first one?
No.
Yes.
Because they just get stupider and stupider and stupider to the point where they're not funny anymore because it's like they're trying too hard to be what they were.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah, isn't there like six?
I don't know.
Or something, yeah.
I believe it, but I have no idea.
It's wild.
Wow.
Yeah, I watched either five or six. And I think, you know, watching the first Sharknado, Caroline, I watched it with you and your family. And it was one of my favorite experiences of my life, just like getting drunk and watching.
Yeah, we love to watch bad movies and have a great snark watch. It's my favorite thing to do.
That's like a fun thing to do in a group, I feel, is watch like a terrible film, have a couple of drinks, watch a terrible film and get to laugh about it.
I'm wearing my Fast and Furious shirts. That's what we do. We have Fast and Furious marathons at Christmas in my family, and we watch them, and we're just like, obviously, your car is going in space. That makes total sense.
Come on now.
Space?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
They kind of go into
the car goes, atmosphere. Isn't it like Ludacris and whatever that go to space?
Yeah.
So. Tyrese go to space at some point.
Hey, guys, they do it for family, okay? I get it.
Yeah.
For family. That's right.
Family.
That's why they're perfect Christmas movies.
Those movies have a moral family. And a message. Yeah. I don't know about this.
It's family. That's the only message.
Well, the mom comes back at the end.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. Okay.
And Dorothy goes back to Kansas.
Badminton is good.
Get her second.
Had a badminton court in your
Meanwhile, you know what? That's my last thing. I have to question why at the end of Return to Oz, Dorothy's like, I have to go back to Kansas. I'm like, to have to help on the farm as a 10-year-old child? You could rule like, Oz. I'm just saying.
And she's probably going to have a follow-up ECT.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I don't think they
Having
have
those said that, we should probably point out that ECT is unfairly stigmatized and can actually have a really good effect if you are experiencing suicidal ideation and depression, because it like opens up your neurotransmitters in a way that is more effective than medicine. So, and it's not, it doesn't shake you. It doesn't cause seizures. Like it's, you're anesthetized. I have someone in my life who was going through a really tough time and did get ECT and it helped a lot.
Wow.
So. Hey,
oh, look at that. Yep. That's it. Well, probably not in 1899, but now I believe it.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay.
Yeah. That's so awesome. Thank you very much for joining us, guys. Can you please tell us about your podcast?
Yes.
And how it came about and what do you guys cover? Yeah.
So we are the co-hosts of Drawn to Darkness, where we swap back and forth. I love horror. And Caroline, what do you love?
I love true crime.
So we take turns. I will introduce Caroline to some horror work of media that I love, whether it's a podcast, a book, a movie, a TV show. And then based on that, she'll choose something true crime
links in. Related. Yeah. So we just kind of work off each other's choices and it's across all mediums. So Annie's a voracious reader. I am the slowest reader on earth. So we go back and forth between books, podcasts, movies, TV series, documentaries, all that.
Yeah. Originally I wanted it to be a book podcast. And Caroline's like, I can't read a book.
I was like, twice a year, we can have an episode.
You guys have a ton of great stuff that covers that's at all manner of different things, which is fun because you get to touch on all sorts of like different subjects. So everybody go check that out. Where can everybody find you guys?
Well, if you just search for Drawn to Darkness in your podcast app, we should be in every single one of them. So you can email us at drawntodarknesspod@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads as well.
Do it. Check it out.
Yeah, check them out, guys.